uncles emigrated to the United States in 1913, the year Haranush started school. As soon as she learned to write, she composed a letter to her father that he carried in his wallet until the day he died. "We all keep hoping and praying that you are well," she wrote on behalf of all her siblings. "And we are going to school every day, and we are trying very hard to be well-behaved children." All written in what Father Balakian would have called a schoolgirl's proper Armenian. In her third year of school, the gendarmes raided Haranush's village. They killed the Armenian headman in front of the terrified villagers before rounding up all the other men. Her grandfather and three uncles were taken away and never heard from again. The gendarmes then led the women of the village to the nearby market town of Palu, where they were shut into a church. The women heard terrible screams from outside the church walls. One girl climbed a high window to observe. Haranush never forgot the horror the girl described. "They're cutting the men's throats and throwing them into the river." From Palu, the women and children of Habab joined the throngs of Armenians on the death marches across Anatolia towards the Syrian desert. "During the march," Haranush later recalled, "my mother was so anxious to avoid the back of the line that she walked very fast, and because we couldn't keep up with her, she pulled us with her hands. At the back of the line, we could hear people crying, screaming, pleading." At the end of the first day's march, Haranush's pregnant aunt became ill and fell to the back of the line. The gendarmes killed her on the spot with their bayonets and left her by the roadside. The elderly, the infirm, the ones who couldn't walk, throughout the march they'd kill them with their bayonets and leave them lying there, just where they fell. As they made their way towards Diyarbakir, the caravan crossed a river in the town of Mardin. Haranush saw her paternal grandmother throw two of her orphaned grandchildren, who could no longer walk, into the water, pushing their heads under the surface before throwing herself into the madly rushing water, this deep grave of tens of thousands of Armenians, as Grigoris Balakian had observed. When they reached the town of Chermik Hamambusha, the local inhabitants surrounded the miserable survivors, looking for healthy children to work in their homes. A gendarme on horseback asked for Haranush, while a man from a neighbouring village asked for her brother Horan. But their mother refused outright. "No one can take them from me. I'll never give them up," Haranush's mother screamed. Haranush's maternal grandmother tried to persuade her to surrender the children for their own safety. "My girl," she pleaded with Haranush's mother, "the children are dying one by one. No one's going to come out of this march alive. If you give these men your children, you'll save their lives." While the women of her family pursued this terrible debate, the men simply seized the children, the gendarme on horseback taking Haranush, the other man seizing Horan. Her mother held on for as long as she could against the man on horseback, but once she relinquished her grip, she lost her daughter forever. The gendarme took Haranush to a farm outside Chermik, where she found eight Armenian girls from her home village of Habab, each snatched from the death march. The girls were left in a fruit orchard, where they were fed and well-treated. At the end of the day, the mounted policeman returned to collect Haranush and took her to his home near Chermik. He and his wife were childless, and the gendarme treated her like a daughter. His wife, however, was jealous of the affection her husband showed the young Armenian girl, and constantly humiliated Haranush by reminding her she was only a servant girl. They gave Haranush a Turkish name, Seher, and taught her Turkish. Though she had lost her freedom and identity, Haranush survived under her new Turkish name. And while many of her family members died under deportation, a surprising number survived. Her brother Horan, taken the same day as Haranush, worked in a neighbouring village where he was known as Ahmet the Shepherd. One of her aunts, her mother's prettiest sister, who had been abducted and married by a Kurdish horseman, not only survived, but managed to track down Haranush in her new home. Most astonishingly, her mother survived the march to Aleppo, where she remained for the rest of the war, and was reunited with her husband, who travelled from the United States in search of his devastated family. However, the Gadarians never saw their daughter Haranush again. Haranush completed the process of her Turkification when, aged 16, she married one of the gendarme's nephews. Her marriage certificate listed her as Seher, daughter of the gendarme Hussein and his wife Esma. Seher spent the rest of her life as a Turkish housewife and raised her children as good Muslims. Grigoris Balekian encountered several Armenians who had converted to Islam to avoid massacre. The change was hardest for adults to accept, but children were more adaptable. Hundreds, probably thousands, of young Armenians integrated into Turkish society, where their origins were almost forgotten, but not quite. Years after the war, ethnic Turks still referred to these converts as the leftovers of the sword. Grigoris Balekian decided to abandon the death march before commencing the fatal desert crossing to Deir al-Zur. He met two Armenian coachmen serving in the Ottoman Transport Corps who had just come from Deir al-Zur, and, astonished to encounter a living Armenian priest, did everything in their power to dissuade Balekian from attempting the march. "How can I tell you so you will understand?" they asked in desperation. "It is impossible for human language to describe what those who went to Deir al-Zur experienced." Yet the Armenian coachmen attempted to capture the horror in words. Thousands of families put on the road from Aleppo to be sent to Deir al-Zur. Of these, not even 5% reached Deir al-Zur alive, because bandits in the desert, in groups on horseback and armed with spears, attacked these defenseless people. They killed, they abducted, they raped, they plundered. They selected those appealing to them and carried them off, subjecting those who resisted to horrific tortures, before picking up and leaving. Because it was forbidden and impossible to turn back, those who survived had no choice but to go forward and were subjected to new attacks and plundering. Not even 5% reached Deir al-Zur. As the coachmen detailed the horrors, they finally succeeded in convincing the Armenian priest that his only chance of survival lay in a carefully planned escape from his Ottoman captors. After divulging his plans to his closest companions, Father Balekian fled the caravan in early April 1916 in the company of an Armenian tobacco smuggler to seek shelter in the Amanus Mountains. The German railway company was still hard at work to complete the tunnels through the Amanus Mountains. The Taurus and Amanus mountain chains had proved the final obstacle to the completion of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. The line was critical to the Ottoman war effort in Mesopotamia and Palestine, and Enver, as Minister of War, had given the German railway company a free hand to recruit whatever labour it needed to complete the long tunnels through the dense mountains. Thousands of Armenians who had fled the death marches found refuge in the tunnel works of the Amanus. Balekian claimed that as many as 11,500 were working on the line in early 1916. They performed heavy labour for subsistence wages, but work on the railway was preferable to the death marches. Here, Grigoris Balekian, who had cast off his priest's robes and shaved his patriarchal beard, began his flight from the genocide. With his fluent German, Balekian soon gained the protection of the Austrian and German engineers working on the line and secured a job as a surveyor. Yet there was no security on the railway line. In June 1916, Turkish officials rounded up nearly all of the Armenian workers for immediate deportation against the protests of the German railway engineers, who argued that the Armenian workers were essential to complete the railway. Balekian was one of 135 specialists spared this latest death march. The few Armenians spared deportation came under increasing pressure to convert to Islam. For Balekian, conversion was not an option. With the assistance of his German colleagues, the Armenian priest fled to another workstation on the railway line under an assumed German identity. Balekian wrote warmly of the humanitarian efforts of German and Austrian civilians, but found the German military men no less hostile to Armenians than the Young Turks. For the remainder of the war, Balekian moved clandestinely or under assumed identities to elude deportation. In this way, the exiled priest survived measures that, by his own estimate, had led to the extinction of three-quarters of Ottoman Armenians by the end of 1915. There is no agreed figure for the number of Ottoman Christians massacred in the course of the Great War. Whereas the population exchanges with Greece were achieved with relatively little killing, Hundreds of thousands of Armenians and Assyrians died in the deportations that began in 1915. The debate persists into the 21st century as to whether the mass murder of Armenians between 1915 and 1918 was an unintentional consequence of war or a deliberate policy of extermination. But even those who deny the Armenian genocide acknowledge that between 600,000 and 850,000 Armenian civilians perished as a result of wartime measures. Armenian historians argue instead that deliberate state policy resulted in the deaths of between 1 million and 1.5 million Armenians, making this the first modern genocide. There is no doubt that members of both the Armenian and the Assyrian communities had made common cause with the Ottomans' wartime enemies. In the spring of 1915, the empire faced invasion on three fronts simultaneously, in the Dardanelles, on the Caucasus frontier, and in Mesopotamia. While helping to explain why the Young Turks unleashed such unprecedented violence against their Christian subjects, this in no way justifies the crimes against humanity that ensued. The bitter irony is that the annihilation of the Armenians and other Christian communities in no way improved the security of the Ottoman Empire. The Allies never mounted an attack on the Sicilian coast to justify the deportation of Armenians there. The deportations actually undermined the Ottoman war effort in Mesopotamia, when Armenians working on the Berlin to Baghdad railway were condemned to a death march. The extermination of Armenian communities in eastern Anatolia did nothing to protect the Caucasus from Russian invasion. Tsarist forces met little resistance in conquering the fortress town of Erzurum in February 1916. The Russian army swept through the Black Sea port of Trabzon and the market town of Erzincan later that year, defeats that could not be blamed on Armenian collaborators after the deportations. It was in the Dardanelles that, against the odds, the Ottomans succeeded in defending their territory against the combined armies of France, Britain, and the Dominions through the courage and determination of their soldiers, not through the annihilation of minority communities. 8. The Ottoman Triumph at Gallipoli. The campaign in Gallipoli evolved quickly from a war of motion to the static warfare of trenches. The Allies had succeeded in landing some 50,000 able-bodied men after the dead and wounded were accounted for. Yet they had failed to achieve the ambitious tasks the war planners had set for them. The British were supposed to roll the Ottoman defenders back and secure the high ground of Achi Baba some 5 miles inland, from which point they would dominate Turkish positions on the Dardanelles. The Anzac troops were not only to seize the ridges overlooking the beaches around Araburno, but also to secure the high plateau across the peninsula to Meidos on the Dardanelles, cutting all Ottoman lines of communication and resupply. Had they managed to achieve these tasks, the Allies would have been in a position to silence the shore batteries in the Dardanelles and open the path to the British and French warships to force the straits and seize Istanbul. Instead, they encountered stiff resistance from the Turkish defenders, who drew lines around Anzac Cove and Cape Helles and doggedly refused to let the invaders pass. 3 times the British and French tried to break through Turkish lines on the tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula to seize the strategic village of Krithia and the Achi Baba Heights. And 3 times they failed. In the First Battle of Krithia on 28 April, the British and French suffered 3,000 dead and wounded, a 20% casualty rate, for little or no territorial gain. The Allies launched their second attempt just 9 days later, 6 May, and after 3 days of battle had lost 6,500 men, nearly 30% of forces engaged, for 600 yards of territory. The third and final Battle of Krithia, 4 June, resulted in 4,500 British and 2,000 French casualties, for gains of 250 to 500 yards along a 1 mile front. The road to Krithia cost the Allies 20,000 casualties per mile. They simply could not sustain the effort. The defense of Gallipoli had exacted a terrible toll on Turkish forces as well. The Ottomans suffered losses on a par with Allied casualties in the 3 battles for Krithia, and fared yet worse in their own attacks on the British and French lines. Under orders from Enver Pasha to drive the invaders back into the sea, the Ottomans mounted determined attacks on Allied lines. The first assault on British positions in Helles on the night of 1 to 2 May resulted in 6,000 Ottoman casualties, and in a second night attack in the same area on 3 to 4 May, the Turks lost another 4,000 soldiers, losses of 40% in just 10 hours. The Ottomans made one further massive assault on the night of 18 May, mobilizing 50,000 infantrymen in a bid to drive the Australians and New Zealanders from their Areburno beachhead. British reconnaissance aircraft had reported the troop concentrations, and the Anzac soldiers were ready and waiting. In 7 hours of combat, the Ottoman initiative failed completely, leaving over 10,000 dead and wounded strewn across the landscape between enemy lines. The soldiers at Gallipoli were learning what their comrades on the Western Front already knew from bitter experience. Attackers stood no chance against well-entrenched defenders with machine guns. After a month of horrific violence on the Gallipoli Peninsula, stalemate ensued. Both sides dug in to hold the lines for which tens of thousands had fought, suffered terrible wounds, and died. The Australians and New Zealanders held their tiny beachhead at Anzac Cove, while the British and French established a line across the toe of the peninsula no more than 3 miles from Cape Helles. While the Turks had failed to drive the invaders into the sea, they had succeeded in preventing the Allies from reaching the high ground. Contained within their narrow enclaves, the Entente armies were subjected to regular artillery, shrapnel, and gunfire from well-hidden snipers, while British and French ships bombarded Turkish positions with their heavy guns. It was trench warfare, with all of the attendant horrors known to the soldiers on the Western Front. The British government reviewed the situation in Gallipoli with mounting concern. The campaign was not going as planned. The naval venture that Winston Churchill advocated had been abandoned after the disastrous attempt to force the Straits on 18 March, and the limited ground campaign Lord Kitchener approved had foundered in the face of determined Ottoman defence. Casualties had been high, the number of able-bodied soldiers on the ground was insufficient to achieve victory, and the sea lanes between Alexandria and Lemnos, the island that served as Allied headquarters for the Dardanelles campaign, were no longer secure. The Ottomans first exposed the vulnerability of British warships on 13 May in a surprise attack on the Goliath. The aged British battleship was at anchor in Morto Bay, inside the Dardanelles, near the southern tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula, providing cover for French forces when the Turkish torpedo boat, Muavenet y Melie, reversed down the Dardanelles towards the Allied anchorage. As it was moving slowly, stern first, the officers on watch mistook the Ottoman boat for a British vessel, an illusion shattered when the Turkish vessel fired 3 torpedoes into Goliath's hull. The British battleship sank in 2 minutes, taking 570 of its crew of 700 men down with her, while the Turkish torpedo boat slipped away with impunity. The arrival of German U-boats later in the month of May transformed the balance of naval power in the Dardanelles. The Allies could hardly complain. British, French, and even Australian submarines had been deployed in the Dardanelles since the British sank the Ottoman battleship Messudia in December 1914. An Australian sub, the AE-2, managed to clear the underwater barriers to reach the Sea of Marmara on 25 April 1915. 2 British submarines, the E-11 and E-14, also navigated the treacherous straits and spent weeks cruising the Sea of Marmara, sinking transport and supply ships carrying reinforcements and provisions to Ottoman forces in Gallipoli. Yet the Allies suffered high losses to their submarine fleets because of underwater hazards in the straits and the confines of the Sea of Marmara. A Turkish torpedo boat sank the Australian AE-2 within days of her arrival in Marmara, and by May the French had lost 2 submarines, the Saphir and the Jules, to submarine nets and mines. German U-boats had a much easier time picking off British ships in the open waters of the Aegean. On 25 May, the German submarine U-21 torpedoed and sank the British battleship Triumph while she was firing on Ottoman positions near Anzac Cove. The ship was struck shortly after midday, within full sight of both armies, a triumph for the Turks and a terrible blow to morale for the Australians and New Zealanders ashore. In the 20 minutes that Triumph took to sink, most of her crew was rescued, though 75 sailors and 3 officers died in the wreck. 2 days later, the same German submarine sank HMS Majestic off Cape Helles, with the loss of 49 men. The capsized hull of the battleship, propped up by her masts on the coastal shelf, served as a reminder of the failure of the Allied navies in the Dardanelles campaign. For with the sinking of 3 ships of the line in quick succession, the Royal Navy was forced to withdraw all heavy battleships from the Dardanelles. Henceforth, naval support for ground operations would be provided by monitors, shallow draft vessels built for shore bombardment, and smaller ships less susceptible to submarine attack. Yet the submarine hazard remained to plague French and British troop carriers and supply ships running between Alexandria and Mudros Harbour, further complicating the campaign. Successive failures in Gallipoli provoked a political crisis in Britain. In May 1915, Liberal Prime Minister H. H. Asquith was forced into a wartime coalition with the Conservative Party. The new cabinet reflected changes in political fortunes. Arthur James Balfour, a member of the Conservative Party, took Winston Churchill's place as First Lord of the Admiralty. Churchill, condemned for his role in the unsuccessful naval campaign in the Dardanelles, was demoted to Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, becoming essentially a minister without portfolio. A new body, the Dardanelles Committee, was created to oversee the Gallipoli campaign, taking the place of the old War Council. The Dardanelles Committee held its first meeting on 7 June 1915 to decide the future of the campaign. Lord Kitchener was still Secretary of State for War and still the most influential voice in the meeting. It is ironic that, to this day, Churchill takes the blame for Gallipoli when Kitchener was so clearly the campaign's most influential decision-maker. He presented the Dardanelles Committee with 3 options. Britain and its allies could abandon the Gallipoli campaign altogether. They could dispatch a major army to conquer the peninsula, or they could continue to reinforce the small expeditionary force under Sir Ian Hamilton in the hope of making slow but steady progress towards the eventual conquest of Gallipoli. The members of the committee ruled out retreat from Gallipoli. They feared the admission of defeat would turn the undecided Balkan states against the Entente powers, and, in the words of the British official historian of the campaign, almost certainly lead to risings all over the Muslim world, a reflection of how much the Ottoman call for jihad continued to preoccupy Entente war planners. Yet the members of the committee had difficulty in deciding between a major campaign force and the status quo, largely because they did not know how large a force might be needed to overwhelm the Turks in Gallipoli, or how long it would take to dispatch such a force. Every delay gave the Ottomans and their German allies precious time to build up their defences further and to make Gallipoli impregnable. In the end, Kitchener came down on the side of dispatching a large body of reinforcements to prosecute a vigorous campaign in the Dardanelles. The commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, Sir Ian Hamilton, had requested 3 fresh divisions. A British division in World War I numbered between 10,000 to 15,000 men, to enable Allied forces to break out of the confines of Anzac Cove and complete the conquest of the Gallipoli Peninsula. The Dardanelles Committee agreed to the dispatch of these 3 divisions in the meeting of 7 June, and at the end of June, Kitchener decided to send 2 further divisions, 5 divisions in all, to give Hamilton the surge he needed for victory in Gallipoli. The first units would reach the front by the beginning of August. Over the summer of 1915, British and French soldiers transformed the rural landscape of Gallipoli into a complex grid of trenches. In the French sector, soldiers marched towards the front down a broad communications trench, optimistically dubbed the Avenue de Constantinople, while those returning from the firing line came down a parallel trench known as the Avenue de Paris. The English, too, gave whimsical names to their trenches. Regent Street ran south from the front line past Piccadilly Circus into Oxford Street and a particularly complex intersection of trenches was christened Clapham Junction, after London's largest rail crossroad. Dozens of smaller trenches were named for the regiments whose men had fought and died there. Lancashire Street, Munster Terrace, Essex Knoll, Worcester Flat. The most ironic names were reserved for the front line itself. Hyde Park Corner, Main Street, and, bleakest of all, Hope Street. The ironic names did little to mask the violence of the trenches. Those who served both on the Western Front and at Gallipoli found the Turkish front by far the more relentless of the two. It is much worse here than in France, in the view of all those who have seen the two fronts. French Corporal Jean Le Monnery wrote home in June 1915. Britons were of the same view. In France, apart from full-dress attacks, an infantryman may live for many months without once firing his rifle or running the remotest risk of death by a rifle bullet, A.P. Herbert claimed. But in those hill trenches of Gallipoli, the Turk and the Gentile fought with each other all day with rifle and bomb, and in the evening crept out and stabbed each other in the dark. There was no release from the strain of watching and listening and taking thought. Life in the trenches assaulted every one of a soldier's senses, sight, sound, taste, smell, and touch. Trench warfare undermined the physical and mental health of those not killed or wounded. Herbert's description of the British experience in the trenches of Gallipoli held equally true for the Turks. Invaders and defenders shared the squalor and horrors of trench warfare equally. From the moment a soldier arrived in Gallipoli, he lived with the sound of artillery. The Allies, however, were most exposed. Ever since the German submarines had driven the British battleships away from the mouth of the Dardanelles, Ottoman gunners on the Asian shores of the Straits had fired with impunity, hitting French lines with particular severity. On the Gallipoli Peninsula, the Turks held the high ground overlooking both Helles and Anzac Cove, and kept up a steady stream of shrapnel and artillery fire. Since we were positioned on the top of Alçatepe, Achi Baba, we were able to fire artillery wherever we wanted, an Ottoman artillery officer claimed. We were able to make war in a way that suited us. The British and French were frustrated in their efforts to locate Ottoman gun emplacements. The Turks used camouflage, decoy cannons firing smoke charges to attract Allied fire, and their mobile howitzers to defy Allied efforts to silence their guns. The Ottomans and their German allies fired at will among the densely packed invaders in Helles and Anzac. Sometimes heavy, sometimes light, sometimes near, sometimes far, artillery harried the soldiers day and night, an unpredictable threat that claimed a steady stream of casualties on both sides of the conflict. In the course of the Gallipoli campaign, the Turks taught the invaders the art of sniping. At first, the Allied troops were terrified by these invisible killers. Ottoman marksmen, camouflaged with green face paint and hidden in terrain they knew far better than the invaders, infiltrated behind enemy lines in both Helles and Anzac Cove after the landings, content to lie there and pick off the infidels till they too died, A.P. Herbert wrote. They were very brave men. Snipers had a terrible impact on the invaders' morale. Nothing in their training had prepared them for it, Herbert continued. They hated the blinded feeling it produced. It was demoralizing always to be wondering if one's head was low enough, always to walk with a stoop. It was tiring to be always taking care, and it was very dangerous to relax that care for a moment. As one soldier reflected in verse, "All day long the snipers sniped, all day long the bullets piped, and men dropped one by one." In time, the invaders recovered from their initial shock and developed into proficient snipers in their own right. Sergeant G.T. Clooney of the Wellington Mounted Rifles found himself exchanging fire with a Turkish sniper within days of arriving in Gallipoli in mid-May 1915. "I had a very interesting duel this morning," he noted in his diary on 16 May. "I put my head up and very nearly had it shot off. So I got to another position and watched, and presently I saw him in a bush just behind the Turk trench at 200 yards. So I got to it, and so did he. We must have fired about 10 shots each, and at last I hit him, and he died there. But by Jove, he gave me a narrow go for it. Clooney made no attempt to hide his glee at killing an enemy sniper. Over time, the Turks came to respect the abilities of Allied marksmen. We were shocked by the fact that the enemy was such a good shooter, Ibrahim Arakan reflected in his diary. Although we went hunting the enemy, they were hunting us. Yet the invaders continued to live in fear of the invisible killer who might strike at any moment. One of the most surprising claims made by British and Anzac troops was that women were active in the battlefield as snipers. There is no record of women serving with the Ottoman army in the First World War, and in view of the segregation of the sexes in Ottoman society, it seems incongruous to say the least. Yet, given the number of British and Anzac claims of women snipers killed, wounded, or arrested, it is hard to dismiss the phenomenon merely as a soldier's myth. A British medic noted in his diary that a wounded Turkish female sniper had been admitted to the hospital in Cape Helles, she having been shot in the arm, though he did not claim to have seen the woman himself. One private from New Zealand gave an eyewitness account. "We got a female sniper, but she was shot before we knew she was a woman. There have been a lot of women snipers about. They are good shots." Private John Frank Gray of the Wiltshire Regiment, who was engaged in operations against snipers around Chocolate Hill near Anzac Cove, claimed the discovery of women snipers was his unit's queerest find of all. He wrote that the women were armed and hiding in trees alongside male colleagues. Some of the women wore trousers, like the men, and some wore full, grey-coloured skirts. They were as thin as could be, and looked as if they had had nothing to eat for months. There is no telling, on the basis of these accounts, if women actually were involved in the fighting, or Allied soldiers were justifying violence against Turkish women by alleging they were combatants. In addition to the relentless dangers of artillery and snipers, the Allies and the Turks regularly dug mines under each other's trenches to kill from below. Corporal Lemonnery was awakened around midnight, his ear to hard ground in his dugout, by the distinct sound of digging in the ground beneath him. As he listened, he heard the regular blows of a pick. "It had to be the Turks," he concluded, "digging a sap to blow up our fort." He quickly found a safer spot to sleep. "The one thing I fear is to end my days blown sky-high over the trenches." He never rested easy in that section of the trenches, fearing the Turks might detonate a charge beneath him at any moment. Lieutenant Mehmed Farsi was more afraid of being buried alive by an underground explosion than of being blown sky-high. The punctilious young officer noted in his daily log that the enemy had detonated a mine so powerful that he had felt the ground heave under his feet. "It occurred where I had heard sounds of digging a few days back," he recorded. "Seven men are missing." Later that afternoon, one of the missing men managed to extricate himself from the debris, much to the Ottoman lieutenant's relief. "There is no worse death than that," Mehmed Farsi reflected. "To face slow death while fully conscious. My God, spare everyone from such a fate." The weeks spent in the trenches were periods of waiting, punctuated by major attacks. The Ottomans and the Allies alternated in taking the initiative, leaving soldiers on both sides of the trenches in a state of perpetual tension. "We were afraid of being attacked," Jean Lemonnery wrote after a period of duty in the French front line. "But I admit we were much more afraid of having to make an attack ourselves." The greatest risks in trench warfare came with the desperate run across no man's land, though it was nonetheless terrifying to hear the enemy swarming your lines. Sergeant Moriarty of the Royal Munster Fusiliers survived the Turkish night attack on 1 May. "They crept right up to our trenches. They were in thousands. And they made the night hideous with yells and shouting, 'Allah, Allah!'" The Munsters fought for their lives as waves of Ottoman soldiers charged their position. When the Turks got to close quarters, the devils used hand grenades, and you could only recognize our dead by their identity discs, the round dog tags that British soldiers wore around their necks. Moriarty fought through the night to behold at dawn the horrible sight of hundreds of Turkish dead covering the ground before the British trenches. "I am sure I will never forget that night as long as I live," he reflected. The Australian war poet Harley Matthews was haunted by the Ottoman war cry Allah, an alien sound that pricked the nerves of all Allied soldiers. "We heard them gathering on the hills again. They called and whistled, bugles blew. Allah," they cried. Then feet came thudding on. Allah. Up on the left the firing grew. In one gust it came down to us. "Stand to. Here they come. Fire." Once more we fire at shouts and shadows, and then gone. They are gone now, all melted as before. For all soldiers, the experience of going over the top proved the ultimate baptism of fire, and a trauma that survivors would never forget. Life in the trenches would be very agreeable, French Corporal Le Monnoy reflected ironically, were it not for the bayonet charges, which are terrible. The men are mowed down by the many machine guns and the excellent Turkish marksmen before they even hoist themselves over the parapet. Robert Eardley was a territorial soldier from Manchester who reached Gallipoli in June. His first attack on Turkish lines came on 12 July, and he remembered each passing second before the fatal order with precision. The moments appeared like hours, the suspense, then the officer, his eyes glued on his watch, following that finger of death, slowly, so slowly, but surely moving to destruction, maybe a second left to live, for this is sacrifice. This is the moment when all hearts are sad and heavy, when you will hear some muttering a prayer. At your side you will notice some poor fellow dreading the approaching time, knowing that death creeps slowly but surely from over there. The anxious soldiers tried to raise one another's spirits with empty words, totally out of measure with the gravity of the moment. "Cheer up, chum. Shake, old mate. Good luck. Hope for the best." And with a final shake of the entire frame of body, the order is given. "Over, lads, and the best of luck." Eardley climbed out of the relative safety of the trenches into the line of fire. He ran across no man's land, bayonet fixed, and marvelled at his own survival. He suffered only a flesh wound to the leg and grazed his nose on a broken bayonet, while his comrades fell dead and wounded around him. To hear the wounded call out for help, to give a last handshake to a dying chum, "As long as I live, I shall never forget my first experience, those few moments of hell." Each attack littered the battlefield with hundreds and thousands of fallen soldiers. Unburied between enemy lines, in the intense heat of summer, the decomposing bodies infused the Gallipoli Peninsula with an intense stench of death. In the early weeks of the conflict, the Ottomans and the Allies agreed to local ceasefires lasting 3 or 4 hours to recover and bury the corpses. On 24 May, the British and Ottomans observed a 9-hour armistice along the Anzac front, following a massive Turkish attack that left thousands of dead. Each side agreed the ceasefire was necessary, but suspected the other of using the hiatus to advantage, to survey the other's trenches and move men and materiel into a favourable position before the resumption of hostilities. After the ceasefire of 24 May, no further break in fighting was agreed to, and the dead began to pose a growing threat to the morale and the health of the living. The trenches are filthy, and at parts of the parapet men are buried with their feet projecting over the parapet, dead for days, "and on either side the dead lie unburied in the sweltering heat," wrote Bartle Bradshaw, a young officer with the Border Regiment, in a letter home. "We do our best to cover them with lime. The stench is awful, and when you realize that what sleep you get is in half yards between the dead, and that you eat what meals you get in the same space, and that if you stop waving a piece of food about for a moment..." Bradshaw left his sentence incomplete because he did not want to write that if a soldier stopped waving his food around, it was soon swarmed by flies, the same flies that covered the dead. A.P. Herbert captured this particular horror of the trenches in his poem Flies, written in Gallipoli in 1915. "The flies, oh God, the flies that soiled the sacred dead. to see them swarm from dead men's eyes and share the soldiers' bread. Nor think I now forget the filth and stench of war, the corpses on the parapet, the maggots on the floor. Clouds of flies carried sickness to the living from the dead. Soldiers on both sides of the lines suffered from the whole range of air and waterborne diseases. The absence of proper latrines left soldiers who feared to expose themselves to sniper fire to relieve themselves in the same trenches where they fought, ate, and slept. Dysentery reached epidemic proportions. Raymond Vey, a French artillery officer, noted with growing concern the spread of disease among his troops. The inoculations given French soldiers against cholera and typhoid gave no protection against fevers and gastric disorders. In recent days, there has been so much illness that even the officers' ranks have been reduced to nothing, Vey noted in his diary. Despite severe restrictions on sick leave, thousands of soldiers had to be evacuated from the front, dehydrated and too weak to walk, let alone to fight. At the height of summer, hundreds of sick men were evacuated from Gallipoli each day. They were sent to hospital facilities at Mudras until they were well enough to return to battle. Living and fighting in the confines of the trenches strained the mental health of the soldiers. Unlike at the Western Front, which provided opportunities for soldiers to take leave in towns and villages removed from the fighting, there was no relief from the violence at Gallipoli. Even when swimming in the sea, the invaders were exposed to random shelling that maimed and killed men desperate for a break from the fighting. Nor could they take refuge in sleep. The continual shriek of artillery, the percussion of impact, and the relentless demands of the front left the men no peace to slumber. Soldiers' journals frequently note how little they slept. "My men are tired," Jean Le Monnery wrote. "And I am too, though I am holding up." He managed only 2 hours of sleep that night, between 2:30 and 4:30 a.m. It was the same on the Ottoman side. "Only managed 2 to 3 hours of sleep throughout the night, and have awful nightmares," Mehmed Fazi noted. As the weeks wore on, the daily anxiety and sleeplessness took their toll, as a growing number of men succumbed to nervous breakdowns or shell shock. A sergeant with the British Field Ambulance Corps first witnessed a case of nerves on 14 June, just 7 weeks into the campaign. Henry Corbridge was horrified by the mental cases, pathetic sights they are, with vacant stare and glassy look, and partial paralysis, some are raving. One case, a giant of a man, who had lost his reason, not a scratch on him, needed 8 men to restrain him during evacuation to a hospital ship. Over the course of the summer, Corbridge noted ever more cases of shell shock. By mid-August, he was recording 5 times more mental cases than wounded. Ottoman soldiers, too, suffered from shell shock. Ibrahim Arakan, a volunteer from the Ottoman gendarmerie, was astonished to find his battle-hardened commander sitting in a foxhole with the sheikhs. "Ibrahim, my son, where are you going?" the captain asked him. Arakan knew something was wrong when the captain, who normally swore at his soldiers, addressed him as "my son." The captain was disoriented and asked Arakan to accompany him. "He had lost his reason and willpower," Arakan recalled. His hand was shaking so violently that he was unable to hold his rifle. Even the hardest men cracked under the relentless bombardment at Gallipoli. Months of combat came to shape how the invaders and defenders saw each other. Whereas the popular press and propaganda had stirred deep hatred for the Germans in the early months of the war, the British, French, and Anzac soldiers had no prior antagonism towards the Ottomans. Allied soldiers gave nicknames to the Turks. The British referred to the Ottomans as Abdul, or Johnny Turk. The French spoke of Monsieur Turk. Even the Ottomans had a nickname for their own soldiers, Mehmed Çik, or Little Mehmed, though they showed no such tenderness to the invaders, whom they branded the English, or the French, or simply Düşman, the enemy. The trenches were at some points so close that the two sides could hear each other speak. Living at such close quarters had a humanizing effect on the men, and in periods of calm they would throw treats across to the enemy trenches. A Turkish soldier remembered throwing cigarettes, raisins, hazelnuts, and almonds into the Anzac lines. The invaders reciprocated with cans of fruit and jam by way of thanks. Emin Çöl found it remarkable that no one ever mixed dirt with the gifts or followed a treat with a hand grenade. The exchanges were made with genuine goodwill. This is not to suggest the Allies and Ottomans were engaged in anything short of total warfare. Both sides committed atrocities, but there were also acts of compassion across enemy lines. Sergeant Henry Corbridge of the Medical Corps recalled treating an Ottoman prisoner who had saved a British soldier's life. The Briton, a sergeant with the Essex Regiment, accompanied the wounded Turk to the dressing station to ensure his protector was well treated. The Turkish soldier had been shot in the arm and leg while helping the British sergeant, who had been pinned down by crossfire between the lines. Corbridge and his orderlies saw that the Turk didn't go short of any comforts which we could give him while in hospital. Private Robert Eardley of the Lancashire Fusiliers had the extraordinary experience of rescuing and being rescued by the same Ottoman soldier in the course of battle. In early August, the Lancashires attacked Turkish lines astride the Krithia Road in the southern tip of Gallipoli. Private Eardley took part in a bayonet charge that overran the Ottoman front line. Once again, he was amazed at his own survival, as he saw comrades fall dead and wounded on either side, as they dashed across no man's land. When he reached the Ottoman trench, Eardley came between a British soldier and a wounded Turk who lay defenceless on the ground. "Here, you get out of my way. He has killed my mate, and I'm going to stick him," the Briton growled. Eardley reasoned with his comrade, arguing that it was a cowardly act to kill a defenceless man. "Put yourself in his place, chum. One never knows. Cheer up, old pa. Don't do it. That's a good fellow," he cajoled. Eardley managed to prevent the angry Lancashireman from killing the Turkish soldier. He found himself alone in the trench with the wounded Ottoman. The two men could not communicate in words, but the Turk made clear to Eardley that he was in terrible pain. "Poor fellow," Eardley muttered to himself as he bandaged the man's gaping head wound. He settled the injured soldier in a safe spot away from the line of fire, put a coat under his head as a pillow, and sat with him for a spell, exchanging signs and glances. When Eardley was called to take up sentry duty, he gave the wounded man a drink of water and a cigarette. I could see by his eyes that he appreciated the kindness, and as the old saying goes, one good turn deserves another. The Lancashire Fusiliers did not hold the Turkish trenches for long. A massive Ottoman counter-attack drove the British troops back to their original lines. Eardley was left in one of the occupied Turkish trenches to cover the retreat of his comrades. He watched as his area was overrun by hundreds of Ottoman soldiers charging with bayonets fixed. The excitement was intense, beads of perspiration on my forehead, our foe galloping on in one great effort to sweep us off the face of the earth. He was surprised by a Turkish soldier who hurdled the parapet bayonet first. I felt a sharp, piercing sensation, a burning feeling at the back of my left shoulder. I knew I had got the bayonet. I distinctly felt the thrust and drawing out. Eardley fell face forward to the bottom of the trench among the dead and wounded, where, suffering from shock and loss of blood, he lost consciousness. Eardley was awakened hours later by the sensation of dirt being shoveled onto his back. As he struggled to stand up, dizzy and disoriented, Eardley found himself surrounded by hostile bayonets pointed towards his chest. He had no doubt they intended to kill him. But before his captors had the chance to strike, a wounded Turkish soldier with a bandage around his head leapt into the trench and protected Eardley with his own body. The Briton immediately recognized his deliverer. The injured Turk was himself quite weak. He had presumably just been rescued by his comrades in their recent counter-attack, but he clung to Eardley for all he was worth and shouted for a sergeant. When the Ottoman sergeant finally arrived, the wounded Turk told his story. "Away they jabber," Eardley recalled, unable to understand a word of what his protector was saying, but recognizing from the expression on the sergeant's face that his chances of survival were rapidly improving. Finally, the sergeant turned and spoke to him in broken English. "English, get up. No one will harm you. You would have died only for this soldier. You gave him water. You gave him smoke, and you stopped bleed, wound from bleeding. You, very good Englishman, and patted my back all over. Before being led away, Eardley took leave of his Turkish friend. I shook hands with this Turk, and would give all I possessed to see this man again. As our hands clasped, I could see he understood, for he lifted his eyes and called Allah, and then kissed me. I can feel this kiss even now on my cheek, as if it was branded there, or was part of my blood. They never saw each other again. Jostled through a hostile crowd of Ottoman soldiers, Eardley was taken up to a communications trench for interrogation. Further on, a hostile soldier dealt Eardley a blow to the chin that knocked him out. He later came to among a handful of other wounded British prisoners. It was a rude reminder that for most Turkish soldiers, Eardley's English uniform marked him as the invading enemy, the Dushman. But Eardley's days in combat were over. He would spend the next 3 years alternating between confinement and heavy labour as an Ottoman prisoner of war. The trenches were taking their toll on the invaders. British and French soldiers were killed by enemy fire or taken prisoner by the Ottomans in steady stream, with a far greater number evacuated from Gallipoli to be treated for wounds, disease or shell shock. Hospital facilities in Mudros, Malta and Alexandria were filled, and a growing number of passenger ships were recommissioned as floating hospitals to cope with the sick and wounded. Many of those who remained in the trenches were too sick with dysentery to fight, but could not be spared from the already thinned Allied lines. Meanwhile, Enver Pasha continued to deploy fresh Ottoman troops from Anatolia and the Arab provinces to reinforce Ottoman lines on the Gallipoli Peninsula. Were it not for the 5 new divisions that Kitchener had dispatched to Gallipoli, the invaders would have been in an untenable position. On 3 August, the first units of Kitchener's new army began to arrive at Anzac Cove to help launch the new offensive to secure the Gallipoli Peninsula once and for all. The commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, Sir Ian Hamilton, had spent weeks refining plans for the August offensive. He recognised that the Allies were in a disadvantageous situation in both Helles and Anzac Cove. The Turks held the high ground overlooking both Allied positions, and the invaders could not break through the Ottoman trenches to reach the high ground beyond. The British needed to break out of the confines of the positions occupied since the 25 April landings, and Hamilton chose to concentrate his forces to the north of the Gallipoli Peninsula, at Anzac Cove and Suvla Bay. The plans for the August offensive were complex. The campaign would begin with diversionary attacks to distract Ottoman forces far from the main battlefield. Allied troops in Helles were to attack Ottoman positions south of Krithia in a feint to prevent Otto Liman von Saunders, the German general commanding Ottoman forces in the Dardanelles, from redeploying soldiers from the toe of the peninsula to Anzac. The attacks in Helles were to be made without any reinforcements, drawing on the war-weary troops who were already in position. Hamilton concentrated 3 of the new divisions that Kitchener provided to the northern front in Gallipoli. He directed 2 divisions to the weakly defended beaches of Suvla Bay to the north of Anzac Cove. He hoped to get as many new troops as possible safely ashore by deploying them where they were least expected. In this way, he hoped to restore movement to the Gallipoli campaign, quickly marching fresh and healthy soldiers, unconfined by trenches, across open terrain to outflank Ottoman positions in the high ground over Anzac Cove, in the area the Turks referred to as Anafata. 1 fresh division was dispatched to the Anzac front to take part in a multi-front attack on the Sara-Baya Ridge. This ridge, punctuated by 3 distinct peaks, Battleship Hill, Düz Tepe in Turkish, Çınak Baya, Jonk Bayra, and Hill 971, or Koca Çimen Tepe, dominated the surrounding landscape and was viewed by the Allied commanders as the gateway to the Dardanelles. New Zealand Major Fred Waite summarised the war planner's thinking. "Win the ridge, and we should win the Narrows," the heavily fortified section of the Dardanelles. "Open the Narrows to the Navy, and Constantinople was ours." Were the Ottomans to be driven from these hilltops, their position would be untenable, and once the Suvla and Anzac divisions joined forces, the entire Ottoman Fifth Army would be cut off and forced to surrender. The whole plan has been admirably conceived by Sir Ian Hamilton. Australian Lieutenant Oliver Hogue wrote in a letter to his wife, Jean. And the staff work has been excellent, down to the minutest detail. It now only remains to be seen if our tactics are equal to our strategy. The British mounted the first diversionary attack in Helles on 6 August. This was the battle in which Robert Eardley was taken prisoner. The carnage he witnessed in the Lancashire's charge was replicated across the front, as Ottoman gunners decimated the ranks of British attackers. On the first day of operations, the British suffered 2,000 casualties among the 3,000 men involved, then on 7 August sustained a further 1,500 casualties for virtually no territorial gains. The Ottomans suffered even higher casualties, with 7,500 dead, wounded or missing in the fighting at Helles between 6 and 13 August. However, the diversion failed to achieve the Allies' aim of pinning down Ottoman forces away from the main front. Liman von Zanders correctly interpreted the Helles attack as a feint and deployed reinforcements from the southern front to face the attack further north. A second diversion planned for Lone Pine to the southeast of Anzac Cove was no less costly to both sides. The Australians mounted a successful bayonet charge that dislodged the Ottomans from their frontline trenches in a position the Turks referred to as Khan le Sirt, Bloody Ridge. Between 6 and 10 August, Turkish and Australian soldiers engaged in hand-to-hand combat in what the Ottomans remembered as one of the most fiercely contested battles of the Gallipoli campaign. Lone Pine stands out in Australian memory as well. Of all those battles fought by our troops at Anzac, none was more fierce and few were more bloody than that waged at Lone Pine, wrote Trooper William Bailbridge. Turkish records show nearly 7,500 dead, wounded or missing. The Australians reported 1,700 casualties. The territory gained by the attack hardly justified the losses, though here at least the Australians managed to pin down a sizeable Ottoman force to facilitate the main offensives further north against the Sara Baya Ridge and Suvla Bay. Australian casualties in 3 other feints were far worse, where inadequate artillery fire had failed to dislodge Ottoman machine guns. 2 lines of attackers were mowed down almost to a man in the midnight assault on the Ottoman position known as German Officers' Trench. The dismounted Australian Light Horse managed to seize 3 Turkish trenches in Dead Man's Ridge before they were expelled with heavy losses by an Ottoman counterattack. But it was the Australian attack on the Neck that came to emblematize the callous waste of life at Gallipoli. After watching the first wave of 150 men mowed down by Turkish gunfire within yards of their trenches, Australian officers blindly followed orders and sent 2 further waves over the top to near certain death. At least 435 of the 450 men who attempted to storm the Neck fell dead or wounded, without inflicting a single Turkish casualty. It was a high price to pay to distract the Ottomans from the main area of attack at Sara Baya. The main Anzac force launched its attack on the 3 peaks of the Sara Baya Ridge under the cover of night on 6 August. 4 columns made their way up the steep valleys surrounding Hill 971 and Chernak Baya in the course of the night. After 2 days of intensive fighting, a combined force of New Zealanders, Australians, Gurkhas and Britons failed to dislodge the Turks from Hill 971, but managed to seize the central peak of the ridge, Chernak Baya. It was the greatest achievement of the offensive, but proved more than the Allies could hold. From the top of Hill 971, which dominated Chernak Baya, the Ottomans subjected the invaders to heavy artillery fire, until they managed to retake the peak in a determined counter-attack on the morning of 10 August. After 4 days of fighting, the Anzac troops looked in vain for relief from the 2 divisions that had landed at Suvla and been expected to join forces with them. By all accounts, the Suvla Bay landing was a squandered opportunity. The British managed to land 2 divisions, over 20,000 men, with relatively few casualties on a beach defended by no more than 1,500 Ottoman soldiers. Disorganization and delay combined to turn a successful landing into a failed offensive. On the night of 6 August, British warships transported two divisions of Kitchener's New Army recruits into position around Suvla Bay, some 5 miles north of Anzac Cove. Those battalions that landed on the southern horn of the bay had a smooth ride, touching down in modern landing craft whose ramps afforded the troops dry feet as they hit the beach. However, those troops assigned to the central coastline inside Suvla Bay faced uncharted hazards in the pitch black of the moonless night. In the darkness, many of the landing craft lost their bearings and motored southward from the designated landing site into treacherous reefs. As the landing craft grounded on shoals and reefs, some of the troops found themselves debarking in neck-deep water. Others were delayed for hours while their boats were refloated. And all were in the wrong location. To compound the difficulties, the defenders set off flares that exposed 3 British destroyers at anchor, discharging thousands of soldiers. Ottoman headquarters were alerted, and the element of surprise was lost before the landing had even begun. As the sun rose, the invaders spent the first precious hours trying to regroup, rather than pressing on to the lightly defended high ground overlooking the Suvla Plain. Several battalions had seen action overnight and suffered casualties, though most of the units were at full strength. However, the delays in getting soldiers ashore meant that the Navy was late in landing artillery and provisions. With little water and no cannons to support them, the British officers decided to limit their aims to securing those hills nearest the landing site, disregarding the objective set out in Hamilton's carefully crafted plans. Worse yet, with their unauthorized delays, the British officers gave their Turkish counterparts time to dispatch reinforcements. Liman von Zonders redeployed units from Helles and Buller to counter the Suvla threat, and he appointed the energetic Colonel Mustafa Kemal as commander of the Anafata Front, which dominated both Suvla and Anzac. After 24 hours ashore, the British commanders decided to give their men a day's rest. The inexperienced New Army recruits were exhausted after a sleepless night's landing and a full day of fighting. They had lost 100 officers and 1,600 men, dead and wounded. They had gone short of food and water in the summer heat, and their artillery had still not been fully unloaded. After so many soldiers had died in precipitous attacks without sufficient artillery cover, the British officers refused to move from their secured beach positions until their men had recovered and had the means to deal with what they erroneously believed to be strongly held Turkish positions. And so the British did not fight on 8 August. Instead, they spent the day swimming and resting. Ironically, had the British commanders attacked immediately, their admittedly tired troops would have faced no significant opposition. As Liman noted in his memoirs, the delay gave him the time he needed to redeploy troops to contain this latest invasion. The British would pay dearly for their day's rest. When battle resumed on 9 August, Turkish numbers had reached near parity with the invaders. The Ottomans had been left in possession of the high ground, giving them a tactical advantage over the invaders. And the Ottoman troops were seasoned veterans, fighting on their own terrain, facing inexperienced recruits armed with unreliable maps. The Suvla scheme, as planned by the Commander-in-Chief, Sir Ian Hamilton, was already doomed to failure. The British official history of the campaign concluded. The British and Ottomans fought pitched battles all day on 9 and 10 August, each side suffering heavy casualties. At one point on 9 August, the artillery was so intense that the brush caught fire and, whipped to high temperatures by the winds, burned British and Turkish wounded alive while their comrades were unable to reach them. Though the British suffered fewer casualties on 10 August, they made no progress in gaining ground from the Turks. Nor were they any closer to providing relief to the beleaguered Anzac troops fighting for the Sara Baya Ridge. After 4 days of fighting around the peak of Chernak Baya, the British withdrew to their original lines in Anzac Cove. They had lost 12,000 men and had no further reserves to keep up the fight. Taking the 3 fronts involved in Hamilton's breakout offensive, Helles, Anzac, and Suvla, the Allies had suffered a total of 25,000 casualties in just 4 days. The Ottomans were also stretched to the breaking point, but had managed to hold their positions despite losses on a par with those suffered by the Allies. Though the joint Suvla-Anzac attack had already failed by 10 August, the Allies continued to pursue the offensive. On 12 August, a party of 15 officers and 250 men from the Norfolk Regiment, all drawn from the Royal Estate in Sandringham, disappeared without a trace. They are believed to have fallen behind enemy lines and been cut down to the last man. Finally, by 15 August, the offensive had ground to a halt, leaving the Ottomans in firm possession of the high ground over each of the three Gallipoli fronts, and the Allies with a longer front line to defend and no place to break through the determined Ottoman defences. The Suvla and Anzac offensives had ended in total failure, and the Allied position in Gallipoli was weaker than before. Hamilton claimed to have lost 40,000 men, sick, wounded, and dead, since 6 August, leaving him with a total fighting force of only 68,000 men to defend a much longer front line. With the addition of Suvla Bay, the Allied front now stretched 23,000 yards. On 17 August, Hamilton requested 45,000 reinforcements to bring his depleted units back up to full strength, plus an additional 50,000 fresh troops. Kitchener, who believed that the five divisions he had just sent to Gallipoli should have been more than enough to secure victory, was unwilling to entertain this new request. He wrote back to Hamilton on 20 August to explain that a big push was planned on the Western Front and warned, "No reinforcements of importance can be directed from the main theatre of operations in France." "Without reinforcements," Hamilton replied, "he would have to relinquish either Anzac or Suvla." Allied losses at Gallipoli and the failure to force the Dardanelles began to influence the volatile politics of the Balkans, to the Central Powers' advantage. After a year of indecision, Bulgaria broke its neutrality to conclude a war pact with Germany and Austria in September 1915. German advances against Russia and Turco-German successes in the defence of the Straits convinced Bulgaria's government that the Central Powers would prevail in the Great War. Bulgaria entered the conflict on 15 October, when it joined the Austro-German campaign against Serbia. Bulgaria's entry into the war proved nothing short of catastrophic for Allied efforts in the Dardanelles. Serbia and Greece requested 150,000 soldiers to protect them from the Central Powers. A Franco-British campaign force had to be mobilized at short notice to send to Salonika in northeastern Greece, with many of its units to be drawn from Gallipoli. Rather than receiving the major reinforcements he required to hold his position, Hamilton had to accept a depletion of his garrison, as whole divisions were siphoned off for service in the Balkans. The Central Powers' overwhelming advances in Serbia transformed the Turkish position in Gallipoli. With the conquest of the Serbian city of Niš on 5 November, Germany and Austria were able to establish a direct rail link from Belgrade to Istanbul, though damage to the rails delayed regular service until January 1916. The Ottoman Empire's European allies were at last free to dispatch cannons and ammunition directly to Turkey, providing a dramatic change in the balance of power in Gallipoli. The British and French viewed the new developments with growing apprehension. Their war-weary and depleted units would now be coming under more regular and more powerful shelling. By October 1915, then, the British government was facing a moment of decision in the Dardanelles. The failure of the August offensive had gravely compromised the Allies' position in Gallipoli. Between losses on the Western Front and the dispatch of another campaign force to Salonika, there were no soldiers to spare for the Gallipoli campaign. Shelling and sniping continued to claim Allied casualties regularly, and the spread of disease weakened those left holding the trenches. The Turks, meanwhile, were only strengthening their positions with powerful new artillery and fresh troops from Anatolia. After months of terrible losses, the British and French faced the very real prospect of total defeat. Better to cut their losses through a successful evacuation than lose everything by trying to hold an indefensible position. Lord Kitchener first put the idea of evacuation to Sir Ian Hamilton in a telegram on 11 October. What is your estimate of the probable losses which would be entailed to your force if the evacuation of the Gallipoli Peninsula was decided on and carried out in the most careful manner? Hamilton was appalled. If they do this, they make the Dardanelles into the bloodiest tragedy of the world, he confided to his officers.